Funding for Think comes from SMU's Informal Courses for Adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Have you ever wished to be somebody else? Most of us have experienced moments of envy. Maybe we've wished we could earn or own or accomplish what others have. But actually assuming the identity of another human being, a person you've never even met, what sort of person would wish for that? To read David Grand's fascinating account in this week's New Yorker, it would seem that that is all Frederick Bourdain has ever wished for, and pretty much all he has accomplished as an adult. Bourdain is 34 years old, balding and prone to 5 o'clock shadow. But until very recently, he has made a career, or perhaps a life, out of convincing people that he was somebody else, most often a boy in his mid-teens. It all sounds impossible, but Bourdain has gotten away with it and gotten caught at it dozens of times. So how does he do it? Why does he do it? And why in the world did so many people believe his outrageous lies? David Grand explores these questions in his New Yorker article, The Chameleon, The Many Lives of Frederick Bourdain. David, welcome to Think.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
Who is the real Frederick Bourdain?
Who is the real Frederick Bourdain? It's a hard question to answer simply. He did... His original identity, which was Frederick Bourdain, I came from a small town in France, a poor family. He didn't have a father. He came from a very broken family. He said that he was abused, and he didn't really ever have a family. He was put in a youth home when he was 12, and he spent from ages of 12 to 16 there. And so he does have, there are certain known facts about him that one can identify and that are confirmable. And at a certain point, he began to kind of tell these fabulous stories, reinventing himself, reinventing who he was, came up with scores of different identities. He would usually, for the most part, only invent them. He would create them. He would imagine them, somebody he wanted to be. And in many ways, he was arrested in time. He would usually create a character who was young, who was an orphan, and he would pretend to be traumatized or abused and look to be taken into a youth home or put in a school. Basically, at least he would say he was looking for love and a kind of family he never had. Others believe it's probably more complicated than that. But in any case, by the age of 16, he had started this, one could call it a career as an imposter, which he basically did. He's 34 now. He's basically done it his whole life, at least his whole adult life. And he always creates a character who is younger. And again, the characters are somewhat similar. He does say, to get back to your question, who is the real Frederick Bourdain? He does say that he tries to hold on to some element of who he really is, so that even when he is always changing identities, some core element of him has remained intact. And the question, some people say that after doing this for so long, after being an imposter for so many years, some people in his family believe his real identity at this point is that of an imposter, is the chameleon.
Talk to us about what he looks like out of disguise.
Well, it's interesting. I met him on several occasions, and every time he looked different. he never looked the same, exactly. One time I saw him, he looked very theatrical. He was wearing all white. He had a white shirt and white pants and white shoes and a little satin blue bow tie. He had a hat pulled down over his balding hair. And, you know, he looked like almost like an actor from a silent film. I mean, there was something like almost Chaplin-esque about him. He, in that situation, his face actually looked very young. When he pulls his hat down, he often, which he does when he gets into character, especially now that as he's gotten older, it's gotten more challenging. And you know, he pulls his hat down, and he has kind of very childlike mannerisms, or he can have. But over the times where I met him, he looked different each time. One time I met him, he had very short hair, and he was dressed almost like he was dressed very ordinary, and there was almost nothing flamboyant about him. And he looked older, and he looked kind of the way you would expect someone of his age to look. So every time I saw him, and I spoke to somebody who, when he was last in Poe, who described seeing him on several occasions, and every time, sometimes he looked like a rapper, sometimes he looked like a businessman, sometimes he looked like a child. So he goes through these kind of different metamorphoses. I should say that, though, in general, when he gets into character, when he pretends when he gets into these roles, he almost always transforms himself into a child. And, you know, he wears a hat which he pulls down, and he has various methods, which we could talk about, that he uses to pretend to be like a child. And he's very effective at it.
I guess part of the advantage of that is that, for one thing, people are always willing to help a child who seems to be in distress, and a child isn't necessarily expected to have positive identification.
That's all those things are true. I mean, what makes him effective is as he himself says, nobody expects a vulnerable child to be lying. And in general, with most cons, you know, most people don't expect other. In our ordinary daily reactions, we have basic expectations of human behavior, and we really, even when we're skeptical, assume that somebody is purposely deceiving them and that they're subverting them. And in the roles that he plays, that's even more so, that people just really don't expect, because the question is that most people would have is, why would you be doing that? It doesn't seem, it kind of defies our assumptions about the way people would behave.
Yeah, you would think that he was doing this in order to sort of take people for something. I guess he got lodging and medical care and that sort of thing, but he wasn't getting rich doing this. And he wasn't deliberately out to hurt the people around him.
No, I mean, he's a very unusual. Almost all the people who prosecute him, and even many of his victims, he's a very unusual in many ways as a con man or an imposter. He's almost sui generis in many ways, in that his motive is not money. He's not there like in a kind of a David Mamet movie to kind of walk away with the prize at the end. He, at least there's been investigations. Most people often assume, well, if he's an older man pretending to be a boy, he must be some kind of pedophile. And at least whenever prosecutors have investigated that, which is always their first assumption, they don't find any evidence of that. By most accounts, he's asexual. So he doesn't have the kind of the motive that we tend to think of for someone in that situation. It really does seem to be emotional and psychological. And, you know, you could trace some of it back to his childhood and some of the things he's trying to replicate. He did have a pretty cruddy childhood, but it's some of it's a little bit inexplicable, and it's probably too... You don't want to reduce it too simplistically to any one particular thing, but the larger point is that his profit is emotional. It's psychological. It's not principally financial. Now, in many cases, many of the people we have duped, which is very unusual, often have sympathy for him even afterwards, because he then tells the story of why he's become an imposter. And he has a very elaborate story about which he kind of tells and goes through his childhood, and he talks about what he's looking for, and he presents himself in a very sympathetic light. Now, some authorities believe that this is kind of his most cunning creation, that of the sympathetic imposter, and in some cases, you know, he does deceive people, and some people, interestingly enough. In his last con, big con, which was in France in Po, where he was, when he was 30 years old, he pretended to be a 15-year-old Spanish orphan. He was put into a French high school. Interestingly enough, the teachers and the social workers were very forgiving, but some of the students I spoke to who knew him were the most angry. They really felt betrayed.
David Gran is my guest. His article in The New Yorker's August 11th issue is called The Chameleon, The Many Lives of Frederick Bourdin. So how did the students get along with him before they knew that this was all a con?
You know, he can be extremely charming, and he was one of the, when he entered the school, I'll use this as a kind of a case study to talk about. I mean, he's done this so many times. I mean, he's done it more than 100 times. But in his last one, where he was in Po in France, he was, when he kind of came into the school, He appeared to be very traumatized, and to be very. He said that his parents had been killed in a car accident. His brother had been killed, and he was from Spain, and he was an orphan. And so, his initial entry into the school and into the youth home where he was he evoked sympathy from people, but he seemed very traumatized. He didn't want to be touched, and But as time went on, he seemed to kind of change, and he became, by the end, he was, you know, people said he was the most popular or one of the most popular kids in the school. He seemed to be able to move between different cliques. You know, every group seemed to kind of accept him. You know, in many ways, he was a kind of a chameleon. So he was not only pretending to be a student, but even with each social clique, he could quickly adopt the mores and the music and the fashions of each different group and almost move seamlessly between them.
He was caught fairly often, and sometimes he would just come out and admit the truth. And you write, this is fascinating, that he seems to have enjoyed that as much as he enjoyed pulling off the ruse.
Yes, and he does. He often, not in all cases, but in many cases, he would disclose the truth. And, you know, I think at some level, the reaction, the sense of attention that he got from doing it, I think is probably a part of his motivation, which gives it a certain thrill. And it's hard to explain, but without question, many times he kind of would disclose the truth on his own. And I guess having people having the knowledge of what he's done, being able to see what he's done, gives him a certain satisfaction. So he is not, in some cases he seems to, and as he's gotten older, he says he more and more just, when he would do it, he just would want to stay that person and he wouldn't want to change. But especially during the earlier periods, he would often disclose it.
Quite chillingly, once the cat is out of the bag, the child falls away instantly from his persona. Can you talk about that transformation?
Sure. I mean, and maybe we should also at some point talk a little bit of the way he has a very elaborate method of getting into being a child, from like the way he walks and the dress, and you know his hair is thinning. He doesn't look like a kid if you see him in his ordinary. You know, he's the last person you think could be a child in many ways.
Yeah, we'll talk about that first then. What does he do to make himself into a 15-year-old boy?
Into a 15-year-old boy. Well, he at first what he does is he tries to imagine a character, somebody he wants to play. And again, it's always as he got older. He used to always be a 14-year-old boy. Once he hit his 30s, he usually made the boy 15. He said for every 6 years, I had a year to the child age. And so, and he would then come up with a name, and he has kind of, you know, I guess from doing it so long, he has these maxims or little sayings, you know, about his kind of his methodology. So he has little sayings like keep it simple and a good liar uses the truth. And what he means by that, excuse me, is, you know, not to come up with such elaborate cover stories that one, that he'll forget it, that you'll get messed up. You know, you don't need to be too baroque. So you come up with certain, you know, you need to know what your parents' heritage is and where you came from, and you come up with a name. He always would try to choose a name that he liked, but also that had some resonance. And interestingly enough, the first character he ever created, the name he used, was the first name. He took the first name and made it the last name, the first name of his father, who he had never met and had never known. And he made the father's name, which was Kasi. He was Algerian. And he made that the last name. He just added a letter. So he takes a name that has some resonance, that some power, so that even when he's nervous, you know, he won't forget it. And then once he's kind of imagined the character, he then tries to take on the tropes of that character. So the dress, he listens to the different music, the popular music of those kids. He'll watch kind of teen shows and kind of read teen literature. He plays teen video games. He kind of takes on all the different tropes of a teenager. He practices his walk. And then one thing he does...
Let me have you stop right here, because
sure,
we've got to take a break, David. David Grand is here from The New Yorker. His piece is called The Chameleon, The Many Lives of Frederick Bourdain. We'll be back in a moment, and we'll hear about how Frederick Bourdain operated in San Antonio for months as the son of a disappeared child. Our number is 1-800-933-5372.
Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. The worlds of Manet, Miro, Marx, and Macbeth are yours to explore. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is David Gran of The New Yorker. He writes a piece in the August 11th issue called The Chameleon, The Many Lives of Frederick Bourdain. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org. So you were telling us, David, about the process that he uses, and it almost sounds, he sounds like a method actor in many ways.
Yes, he uses similar techniques, and he often says, like a method actor, he tries to find something within the character that's inside himself. He kind of mines his own psyche through a microscope, he says, to kind of find that element. But he also always says, he has this refrain that he says, people always say to me, why don't you become an actor? And he says, I know I would be a very good actor, but I don't want to play somebody. I want to be somebody.
Hmm.
And I should just make one caveat, because I do think there's a tendency when we talk about imposters to kind of mythologize them and to mythologize the routine. And when I describe the routine, I do think it's important to keep a little bit of distance that, you know, he himself tries to mythologize his routine as he goes through it. And I think clearly there's a tendency in our culture, I think, to kind of mythologize them and romanticize them. And I want to make sure that I'm not doing that. That when he does have this method and he has this routine that's kind of practiced over the time, but partly when I describe his routine in the article is I'm describing as he describes it and in many ways the way he kind of envisions it. And he kind of, you know, he watches movies all the time, and it's kind of, it's hard to know where the culture begins and the real thing ends, that the culture of movies influence the real people and vice versa.
What a challenge for you. I mean, you and I both know people try to lie to reporters all the time, but not like this.
Yes, I have to say it was one of the hardest stories I've done. He describes himself as a professional liar, and authorities describe him as a pathological liar. Interestingly enough, on certain elements, you had to be very skeptical and critical. Often, I found when he would describe certain elements of his life, he's oddly actually very fastidious. So, for example, when he describes, you know, let's say he pulled some con, you know, like in Poe, he'll be extremely fastidious about the facts. It's almost like he wants it to be rendered accurately his creation. So I found that a kind of a contradiction or a curiosity that, you know, for someone who says he's a professional liar, he was oddly fastidious. But in his case, you really had to, you know, get his story, and I spent a lot of time with him, and then you need to kind of report with everybody around him. The good thing, or the thing that made it more viable, was, you know, he's done this for so long, and he's intersected with so many people, and he's intersected with a lot of clinics and youth homes and schools and hospitals. And so I was able to get, you know, Interpol has files on him. So I was able to kind of get records that then would correspond with what he was telling me. And interestingly enough, there wasn't as, when it came to emotional or kind of motivation, I was a little more skeptical. But when it came to kind of what he described in his life or even his real childhood, he was actually pretty, like I said, pretty fastidious about the facts.
And did he have a job in between these, I guess you can call them gigs, or did he have someplace to live?
You know, he really didn't. I mean, he's never, oddly enough, the one job I know, now he does.
We'll talk about that later.
Yeah, but
it's funny.
For most of his career, he's never had a job. And the one time I know when he had a job was in 1995, he was starting to get some notoriety in Europe. Interpol was on his case, and there had been some French articles about him. And a French television show, it was a very popular show at the time, and the host is still actually very popular in France, wanted to have him on a show, and they tracked him down. He'd actually been in Ireland. He had just done a gig, let's say, in Ireland. And they invited him on the show, and they were so, and he told his story about kind of, they asked him, you know, why do you do this? And, you know, he told his story in a very sympathetic manner, and the hosts were so moved, and the producers of the show were so moved, that they gave him a job in the newsroom. And as he said, he was a pretty good reporter because he could find anyone, he could get anyone to talk. But after, you know, just a few weeks, he just took off. And one of the producers said he ran off to continue, quote, his interior fictions.
My guest is David Gran. His article in The New Yorker is called The Chameleon, The Many Lives of Frederick Bourdain. So let's talk about, he's really an incredibly fast thinker on his feet. At one point, he impersonated a teenager and several different adults in the span of a couple of hours, and then he found himself headed for Texas.
Yes. Yes. I mean, it's clearly the most kind of incredible, far-fetched, kind of hard-to-believe element of his story, which is already a very strange story. But in 1997, it was October of 1997, I think my date's right, October of 1997, he was in Spain. He was pretending to be a kid. He hadn't given his name. And by that time, you know, he was getting more and more notoriety in Europe, and Interpol was trying to track him down. And there was a judge in Spain who was suspicious of him. And he was in a youth home, and the judge said, you know, you have 24 hours to, you know, give me some identity that's verifiable, give me some papers, or we're going to fingerprint you. And Bourdain knew his fingerprints were on record with Interpol, and that if he was fingerprinted, he would be caught. And he was older by then, and he knew for the first time he would face an extended jail sentence. So in the youth home, he asked permission to use the office where he was staying, and they said yes. And when he was in the office, he started to troll for a real identity, and he figured he would try to find an identity that would be harder for the authorities to check, so he wanted to find an American identity. And he did something that as he concedes is pretty evil, or very evil. He called up the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, and he said that he pretended that he was the head of the youth home, that he was a social worker, and he was the head of the youth home, and a boy had shown up at the shelter, and he had an American accent, and the shelter didn't know who he is, but they were sure he was American, and could you help me identify him? And so they said, well, what does he look like? So Bourdain, playing the social worker on the phone, gave a description. Of course, the description matched himself. And so they said kept going through their files until finally they came up with someone they thought it might be. And they said it might be Nicholas Barkley, who had disappeared from San Antonio in 1994 when he was 13 years old. And Bourdain at the time was 23. Nicholas Barkley would have been 17 by 1997. So the clinic, the Center for Missing Exploited Children, said, we'll send you his missing persons flyer. Bourdain, meanwhile, then called the San Antonio Police Department and said, look, you know, I spoke in the center. And this time he pretended to be a cop. And he said, we have this kid, Nicholas Barkley, and he's been found. And the police says, well, we'll – and he again gave various identifying characteristics, which he had picked up from talking to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children about Nicholas Barkley, like that he had a pink backpack when he disappeared, Nicholas disappeared. And so the police department then contacted the family and the FBI and the State Department, and suddenly Bourdain said he had not fully contemplated what he was about to unleash, but suddenly the family is contacted, and the sister, the half-sister of Nicholas Barkley, and they say, look, we found your brother, we believe, is in Spain. And so she says, and she flies to Spain to retrieve her brother, who is really Frederick Bourdain. And one can only imagine what that encounter was like, where you have a Frenchman who's 23 about to meet the sister of the real Nicholas Barkley.
Now, let's talk about the plausibility of the story here, because I think it speaks to his ability to convince people of anything.
Mm-hmm.
He was 23 years old. He had dark brown eyes, dark brown hair, naturally, and a distinct French accent.
Yes, yeah. What happened was, after he had called the police department, he had asked the Center for Missing and Exploited Children to mail him overnight the missing persons flyer for Nicholas Barkley. And when he got it the next day, he opened it up, and he suddenly realized that he didn't look anything like Nicholas. He had the wrong hair color. Nicholas's hair was very light. Nicholas's eyes were blue, and Frederick's eyes were brown. Nicholas had a tattoo of a cross between his fingers, and Frederick didn't have a cross between his fingers. So in a panic, he burned the flyer. He then got a bottle of bleach and dyed his hair, although I would say not very convincingly. He put on a hat. He put on sunglasses. He had a friend give him a tattoo, almost like a prison tattoo, of the cross between his fingers. And he then tried, as he always did, to come up with some backstory to explain who he was, although in this case, the story was kind of crazy and had to explain, you know, why the eyes were a different color. And he claimed that he had been abducted and by a sex ring, and they had experimented on him and you know, flown him to Europe, and he had been held in captivity, and he had never been allowed to speak English, and which is why, you know, that would explain the accent. So he kind of went through this process coming up with this story, this kind of cockamamie story. But he tells it in, you know, as he always does, an incredibly convincing fashion, and somehow managed to persuade Nicholas's half-sister, Carrie, and even the authorities. And it's hard to believe this happened, but I guess it was the pre-9/11 world, but he was brought to the U.S. Embassy, and within, you know, a few hours, he had a passport, and he was on the plane for the United States as Nicholas Barclay.
No fingerprints, no DNA testing, no dental records.
Nothing.
And I guess part of the reason was that people were happy to have this story come to a happy conclusion. The sister said it appears to be him. He gets home to San Antonio, or what should have been home, and has kind of a queer reaction from some members of the family.
Yes, I mean, you know, and the story gets very complicated at this point. But he you know, the sister is, you know, really embraces him and her family, and by all accounts, just, you know, desperately wanted to believe. This was her brother. The mother of Nicholas Barclay seemed a little more standoffish and hesitated, for example, at the airport before greeting him. But they eventually do take him in, although he doesn't live with his mother. He ends up living with Carrie, the half-sister, and her family. So she goes to live with him. They live out in Spring Branch, Texas, an area you probably know better than I, but outside of San Antonio, and they live in a trailer, and it's kind of surrounded by woods, and it's pretty remote. And I don't think Frederick, I don't think that was exactly his vision of where he'd be going. But
well, we should say, by the way, Carrie at this point was an adult with kids of her own that were in their teens.
That's exactly right. And the kids, you know, were young, but, you know, Frederick, when he got into that house, you know, he suddenly was in a situation where he hadn't been before, and suddenly he had to persuade people who knew that person that he was that person. It was the first time he'd ever pretended to be a real somebody else. And not only did a lot of people steal other people's identity, but they never intersect necessarily with the actual family. So someone may steal your Social Security number or something, but the FBI, according to them, at least they have no record or no memory, when I spoke to them, of a case where an imposter had successfully deceived the family, had successfully pretended to be a missing child and successfully deceived the family. There is no FBI case, at least that they know of, when I spoke to them, on record.
So you think they can be forgiven for sort of believing him at first?
You know, you mean the authorities?
Yeah.
I mean, I think to them that was some of their thinking. I mean, you know, I think to some extent they just, you know, went back to what we were talking about earlier in the conversation, which is, again, it just so defies expectation in a way. It's such a big lie. Almost the bigger the lie, the harder to believe. And I should also point out that, you know, one of the things we come to think of cons as being these kind of scientific, you know, these perfectly calculated,
almost superhuman.
But one of the things that an imposter does and a con man does is they try to get you to suspend disbelief. And so the thing about most cons is they seem, once you know about them, they seem preposterous after the fact. But this case in particular seems preposterous after the fact.
Yeah, but he had a way of, one person would tell him a story about, remember when we did this, Nicholas? And then he'd go back to another family member and say, oh, I was just thinking about how we did this. And nobody put together that he'd been told that story.
No, exactly. He would mine. He when he got into the house, he quickly started to kind of mine each person for different memories. And then he would bring up those memories with the other person. He also began to look at videos, home videos in the house of Nicholas, so he could try to imitate him. The way he would sit, and the way he would move. And he then went through, at one point he was given some of Nicholas's letters. So he tried to learn everything he could about this real kid to keep up the ruse and keep people convinced.
So for a while, he was sort of cooking with gas as Nicholas Barkley. He had been accepted by the family, but there was a private detective in San Antonio that was hired to sort of look into the case.
Yes, Charlie Parker, who is a wonderful character. He's a private detective and hard copy at the time. It's no longer in existence, but the tabloid television show at the time had wanted to do a story on the return of Nicholas Barkley, and they had called Charlie Parker and said, can you help us find this guy and look into his kidnapping? Now, they weren't suspicious at all. They were just taking the story at its face value, which seemed amazing that this Texan kid had been kidnapped and taken over to Europe and now was found and back. So Charlie began to investigate the case, and he tracked down Frederick or Nicholas to Carrie's house out in Spring Branch, and he went out there with a TV crew from Hard Copy, and they're interviewing him, and he just keeps looking at him, and he sees that there's a picture of the real Nicholas Barkley on the shelf, and he's looking at Frederick Bourdain. He just keeps looking at them, and he says, something just didn't add up. And he had once heard that ears are like fingerprints, that no ear is distinct. And so he told the cameraman, zoom in on his ears, zoom in on his ears. So the cameraman zoomed in on Frederick Bourdain's ears, and they took the footage of it. And then Charlie quietly slipped the real photograph of Nicholas Barkley, and he put it in his pocket, and they left. And they took off. And then when he got back to his house, he started to examine the ears between the real Nicholas and the fake Nicholas, and it was then he knew that something wasn't right.
But the story does not end there. We'll hear a little bit more about it in just a moment from David Gran. His piece in The New Yorker's August 11th issue is called The Chameleon, The Many Lives of Frederick Bourdain. We'll be back with more of the story in just a moment.
Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. The worlds of Manet, Miro, Marx, and Macbeth are yours to explore. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest for this hour is writer David Gran. His piece in The New Yorker is called The Chameleon, The Many Lives of Frederick Bourdain. If you'd like to join us, our number is 1-800-933-5372. So Charlie Parker becomes convinced that Frederick Bourdain is not Nicholas Barkley. He worries that he might be a terrorist, so he calls the authorities, and he calls the woman who believed that this might be her son.
Yes, he called Nicholas's real mother, and he said, look, and he tried to break it to her delicately, and he said, look, I don't think this is your son. And he explained, he had looked at the ears, and he explained that he had called language experts who said if you had been even held in captivity for 3 years, you would quickly regain your accent. And he kind of went through the litany of what his investigation had revealed. And he said that even though she was upset, she insisted that it was her son, and as did the rest of the family, insisted that it was Nicholas Barkley.
So finally, all this time goes on, and Parker continues trying to convince the family, and they won't hear of it. And finally, he sits down with Bourdain as Nicholas Barkley in a cafe.
Yes, so eventually he's at a cafe, and by this time, Frederick had been playing Nicholas for 5 months, or nearly 5 months, and he had become psychically pretty frayed. And he says he just wasn't used to pretending to be a real person and having to convince the real family. And he had really started to unravel towards the end. And when he was at that cafe with Charlie Parker, he finally admitted that he was Frederick Bourdain and that he was wanted by Interpol.
And then, I don't know if this was one of those cases, but in many cases, as we mentioned earlier, once he'd be found out, he didn't sound like a child at all anymore.
No, he does. He quickly, becomes a man and changes. In that case, the shift was dramatic, but not as dramatic as in other cases. Nicholas was 17 at the time, but for example, in the Poe case, when he was arrested, his voice suddenly dropped to that of man, and he said, "I want a lawyer." They knew right away he wasn't a 15-year-old boy.
But Bourdain himself started to wonder what then had happened to the real Nicholas Barclay.
Yes, and when Bourdain was in custody, he then made some allegations against the family. He alleged that the mother and Nicholas's stepbrother may have been somehow involved in Nicholas's disappearance. Now, authorities said, this guy tells a million lies, and we can't believe anything he said. But they did have some questions which they wanted answered, because for them, there were just certain oddities that they wanted to look into and investigate. I mean, the big one was just how could the family, the mother, have believed that this was her son, given how different he looked, and how could she have believed it for a 5-month period? So they then began to conduct some investigation.
And the case to this day remains unsolved.
Yes. I mean, the authorities look, it's important to say that they looked into it and they never found any evidence to incriminate anybody. Nobody was ever charged, and the case remains unsolved to this day. But they did look into Bourdain's charge, but they never found any evidence that would the prosecutor in the case never found any evidence. Now, one of the people they had questions about was the stepbrother of Nicholas Barclay, and he committed suicide shortly after they began to investigate him. And so that also facilitated them not being able to solve the case if there was any involvement by him, because they couldn't speak to him. Now, the family insists that they were just that they just wanted desperately to believe, and that Bourdain was a very effective imposter. And they kept saying, they just kept making excuses because they so desperately emotionally wanted this to be Nicholas.
What's so interesting about the whole story is that it points to the fact that at a certain point, people can believe things they know to be untrue.
Yes, the power of wanting can be very strong, and the thing about cons, like I said before, is we think of them as so sophisticated. Usually, most cons in real life are filled with inconsistencies. Things that don't quite add up, but for whatever reasons, and the reasons can be different in each case, people suspend disbelief.
David, I know that you've covered a lot of really interesting stories as a reporter, prepared for a lot of interviews. What sort of things went through your head that were different when you prepared to meet Frederick Bourdain for the first time?
Well, I didn't know if he would. I mean, some of them were almost basic, would he show up? Mm-hmm. I didn't know what he would be like, and it was kind of hard to find him and know, would he show up? And I guess the biggest thing when you go into a story like that, when you're going to sit down with someone like that, is, are they playing you? You can't help but be worried that, if somebody their whole life is kind of conning and a life built on deception, you can't help but think, is this person deceiving me? Both, maybe it's just in terms of whether the story, or maybe even in some grander fashion. And so, you're a little bit uneasy and you're just on guard and about those things. And then over time, I should say, as I spent more time with Frederick, I felt more comfortable. But in that first encounter, those were the things I was thinking.
It still had to be a heck of a project for the fact checkers at the New York.
Oh my God! Yes, yes, that was definitely it was, and it is a story where even with a Texas incident, you know, everybody's telling you different things. The family says one thing, Frederick says one thing, the authorities, you know, make other claims, and my approach in general with those things is just to kind of let everybody, there's some cases where truth is murky and, you know, you wish you were omniscient and you wish you knew all, but in a case like that, you know, I just felt like my goal was to make sure I just presented each side and just kind of let what I knew out there and let the reader kind of try to come to their own judgments.
Did you like him?
Did I like him? We had there were periods early on where he was sometimes difficult, but he was very charming through most of it, and up until the end, and after the article comes out, he's called me several times and we speak, and he's been actually very, for the most part, he was extremely charming throughout the process.
So he told you that he had moved sort of to a small town to avoid the limelight. Are you able to believe that he doesn't want the attention?
You know, it's so hard to know. I think in a case like that, the only way we'll really know is with time. Only time, I think, will be the judge. But the thing that's so amazing is his whole life he has said his quest has been for family and love. That's always his refrain. Going all the way back to when he was a child, whenever he gets caught, and when anybody asks him why he does what he does, which seems inexplicable, he always says, all I want is love, all I want is family, the two things I never had growing up. And in the last year and a half, this project took a long time, and when I first met him, he went through an incredible transformation towards when I last saw him, which is he met a woman, and they got married. Interestingly enough, when Bourdain told his family, his mother and his grandfather and some other relatives that he was getting married, they didn't believe him, and nobody came to the wedding. Or I guess one relative came, but most of the relatives told me they didn't show up because they didn't believe him. One said they even tried to check, with the town hall to see if, he was really on record. But he did. He got married, and his wife recently had a baby, and so he now is a father, and he has a wife, and he's held a job, and he hasn't done any over the last 2 years he hasn't done any cons, and his life has gone through a radical transformation. So he has what he says he always wanted, and I think only time will be the judge to see if that's true.
Did he seem happy to you?
He did at times. Yes, I think so. I mean, I'm always. These judgments are so hard. You spend time with someone, and he certainly seemed perfectly contented when I was with him. And but he has seemed pretty happy. He seemed pretty happy as a father. He's called me, seemed pretty proud, and so I would say yes. I mean, he himself often says, that he's had such a troubled life that he's not someone who's naturally happy. But he does, he's at least taken on all the outward signs of normalcy. His family believes that this is going to end disastrously for the wife and for the baby, more importantly, and that this is just another role he's playing.
He has been evaluated by professionals who say that he is not a psychopath. He is not insane. What do you think about that?
It's interesting. I find that they have repeatedly evaluated him to see whether he's fit to stand trial and should he stand trial. They've always determined that he was sound. He's a screwed up person, though. I don't think he would be the first not to say that. So I guess it's the boundaries of what we considered sane or not. I mean, he clearly, based on all these evaluations, he's not a psychopath. He's not a sociopath. In his last evaluation, this psychiatrist, it was a French psychiatrist in this case who evaluated him, said that he's not a psychopath, but that it was possible, as he keeps doing these things, that he could develop into one, and that they had a very pessimistic prognosis that he could really change.
And he keeps, Bourdain himself keeps journals and writes poetry and that sort of thing, and has written a bit on the subject, hasn't he?
Yeah, he does, and he has very much. When he was, after he was caught in Texas, he actually did. What's interesting is the Europeans always seem to just let him go. And in Texas, he did 6 years. Now, the crimes are very different, I should say, because there he impersonated a real kid and had real many more consequences for his deceptions. But he did, when he was in prison, he actually read and studied about psychopaths and sociopaths, and he wrote about it. And in his poetry, one of the things he always writes about, and when you talk to him, one of the things he always talks about is not wanting to become a monster. And that he has a saying, you know, when you fight monsters, don't become a monster, which I think actually, you know, probably I think maybe influenced by Nietzsche. But that seems to be in his life. He considers it kind of an internal struggle that he doesn't want to become the sociopathic imposter. Some authorities and some in his family believe that, you know, if he does, as he's been doing this for so long, that's what he's becoming.
Can you talk about what specifically his job is now that he actually has a 9-to-5 career for the first time?
Yeah, well, he is in telemarketing. and he does calls. And he, as he told me, he said, you know, he's unusually good at it. As he said to me, you know, just let's say I'm a natural. And I'm sure it's true that he can persuade people of pretty much anything.
So you said you still sort of keep in touch with him now. How much do you worry that this will end disastrously in some way?
You know, you worry about it because there's a baby involved now. And it just changes the equation whenever there's a child involved. You really worry about the well-being of the child. He's had an incredibly troubled history, and so you can't help but worry. The wife and Frederick, you know, insist that they will prove everybody wrong.
I guess we can only hope that that's the way it turns out.
Yes.
David Gran is a staff writer for The New Yorker. You can read his article. It's called The Chameleon, The Many Lives of Frederick Bourdain in the August 11th issue. And in the article, we should say there's a picture of what he looks like today. So you can take a look at that. David, fascinating story and very well told. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.